Yeah. Paul Mortensen, alcoholic.
Hi, Paul.
Yet I have not taken a drink since May 5th of 2001. And I always like to say that's due to the grace of a God that will never help me, sponsorship that should not be trusted in a simple program of action that's never going to work. And I tend to be a bit of a skeptic, and I don't believe it until I see it happen a couple of times. And even then, I'm still kind of not certain how they really got the results. And I'm inclined to stand back and watch. What's different about that is that when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had something that you can't get in Walmart, you can't get it at the courthouse, you can't get it in treatment, you can't get it from your mom, your dad, your cousin, your dog, your cat, or anybody else. I had what they call desperation. I was just that damn desperate. I came here to you, I'd like to say by accident, but I think it's a moment of grace. I think that there are points in my life where it's coincidence, where it's accident, where I didn't intend for something to happen. And for me, I've come to believe that there's moments in my life where there's a God out there who I knew was never going to help me because of the things I did and the way that I lived and the stuff that I did. And yet he was there doing it anyway. And I've come to believe that the word grace isn't something I deserve or something that I earn or something that I go pick up anywhere. Grace is a gift that is given for no good reason. It's something that's not earned. You can't buy it. You can't find it. It's something that's given for no reason at all. And I think that it's based on love. And I think that that's what AA is all about. It's about us being together here, and we've gotten through something together that we can't get through. We can't get through it by ourselves. People die from this all the time, you know. And it's not something that thousands of years people were having alcoholism, you know. And we weren't able to get over that. And somehow, somewhere, out of nowhere, I think God must have just kind of felt sorry for us and said, you know, we're going to have to give these guys something, and he gave us this. When I say I'm alcoholic, what that means to me is a couple of things. You know, first off, when I drink, I get thirsty. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous calls that the phenomenon of craving. When I drink, I want another drink. And every time I take a drink, I want another drink, and I want another drink. And once I start, I don't know where I'm going to stop. It's going to be 16, 12, 14, 25, whatever, you know, and the odds are relatively high that I'm going to be throwing up one more time tonight. I also have a thing called the obsession of the mind. The obsession of the mind is the part of my brain that's constantly lying to me, telling me that I can safely drink, that I can have a drink, that I can have a couple, that this time it's worth it, it's okay, that I can have one, I should, I could, I ought to, because of her, because of that, or because of this. I got the job, lost the job, found her, lost her, whatever. I always come up with some reason why it's okay for me to take a drink. Once I take the drink, I get thirsty. The more I drink, the more thirsty I get, the more I drink, and I'm sick again. And I wake up the next morning with a firm resolve to knock that off and cut it out and not do that again. And guess what? My brain keeps talking to me. And it wasn't until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that anybody ever described that. You know, I mean, I had a lot of people tell me about, you're drinking, you know, pointing the finger, you're drinking, and if you did this, if you didn't do that, and blah, blah, blah. And it was like the Charlie Brown episode, wah, 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 wah. You know, I'm not hearing anything. It's like, you don't understand. You don't know what it feels like. You don't get it. You know, you don't know what this does for me. So, I'm alcoholic. I can't safely drink, and I can't not drink. Those are the two things I think that qualify me as an alcoholic. I did a lot of drugs. Drugs are a part of my story simply because I planned on being not being a drunk like my mom. So I started out on non-addictive marijuana. Guess who got arrested for that a couple times? Because it was not addictive and I didn't have to do it. That's why I was dealing it, so that I could, you know, support my habit. But really, I don't consider myself an addict because given a good enough reason, I stopped. I mean, I got in trouble one time too many, and I had too much to lose, and I didn't do it anymore. I cut it out, and I was able to do that. And yet, given reason after reason after reason after reason, I could not stop drinking. So, it's water. So, I'm not going to give you a long drunk log. I'm not going to give you the story, the war stories, the misery, the pain, and the hurt. Bottom line, you all know how you got here. My story might be different than yours, but most of us don't come wandering into Alcoholics Anonymous because things are going well. There was a her. There was a lot of stuff going on. I was in the middle of a divorce. There was a lot of problems. And there was a lot of stuff that I was very emotional about because I'm too damn tough to have any emotion other than rage and fine. And so I couldn't put a finger on, you know, terror and bewilderment and frustration and despair. I didn't know those words. I knew them. I'd read them in books, but I couldn't put it to my situation. I didn't get it. And I wandered into Alcoholics Anonymous because the night before, there was this girl, and we got into a fight, and I threw stuff around. I broke stuff. I tackled her. We got into a wrestling match. I slapped her on her rear end 3 times with a flat hand, which for me, that's hitting a woman. I don't care how you dress that up. You don't strike a woman in anger, and that's what I did. And that's what I saw in the mirror the next morning, and I just knew. I'm a drunk. I've been a drunk for a long time. I'm a violent, angry, rageful, frightened person with nothing left in the world and the reason to go on, and what the hell's the point, you know? And the next day when she came back, she said that her and her friend Keith were going to be going to a dance. It was an AA dance, and I could go if I wanted to. I thought, ah, Christ, you know, AA and a dance. I mean, I don't dance, you know, not because I can't dance, but because I won't dance, because if I get out there and I dance, you're going to see that I feel awkward and vulnerable, and if you notice that, you're going to stop. The whole room's going to turn, laugh, and point. The earth is going to open up and swallow me, and psychologists like to say I have anxiety attacks. Bottom line for me, what it is self-centered fear. I am absolutely terrified that you're going to be able to see through the thin little disguise that I've been able to throw up between me and you. That little bit of buffer that I used to try and make me tough, whether it was my leather jacket, ponytail, and a long goatee, or whether it was in the 80s, the fishnet shirts and the cut-off shirts and the ripped-up jeans. And so, whatever it is, it's all just image. My desperate attempt to be something other than what I feel like is always out there trying to show you something that I'm not, because I'm afraid if you see what I am, it'll all be over, you know. And I didn't know that that was the answer. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard someone describe from the podium what it's like when I drink and what it's like when I don't. The desperation and frustration of sobriety, you know, and how painful that that is for me. I didn't know that other people knew about that. And the best way I've heard it described, for me, sobriety is like being underwater. It's like being underwater, and I can see the surface, and I need to breathe, and I know that I need to breathe, but I'm not going to go there. I'm not. And that's me fighting a drink. And the longer I'm underwater, the more desperate I get, and the more frustrated I get, and the further the water surface seems to be, until I finally crack and say, forget it, and I surface, and I feel like, okay, I'm going to be okay. And that kind of goes away pretty quickly, you know, because the more I drink, the worse it gets. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was lucky enough that first meeting that I was at, that there was a person there who shared their experience, not what they know. They shared their experience, they shared their story, they gave me their experience, and they told me where they got their strength and how they got their strength, and that gave me a little bit of hope. You know, they didn't. Luckily, I sobered up with a person in Alcoholics Anonymous who was talking about their experience. I didn't sober up at, say, Age Orange Harley Book Study, because I would have gone into that with the amount of intelligence and knowledge and wisdom and religion that I had in here, and I would have been able to take apart everything you said, call you a liar, a blasphemer, and a fake, and walk out of here and get drunk, you know? So I had people sharing their experience, and that's a big deal to me. And I can't take credit for any of this stuff either, because, you know, there's a good way to put it. There's a story about this guy. He's in this book I read a long time ago, and for the sake of argument, we'll call him Moses. And he was given a job to take these people and lead them out of this place, and he gets them out in the desert, and they get lost, and everybody's mad at him. And what happens is, the longer he's out there, the more annoyed he becomes with these people, and the more he wishes he didn't have this job. He's like, this is terrible. You know, these people are jerks. And the longer he's doing it, the more annoying they get, and the more irritating they get. And he finally gets to this point where the people are coming to him saying, hey, we want water. He's like, ugh. Goes in his tent. He's like, God, these people want water. You know, what do I do? God says, well, go out there and talk to that rock, and it'll give you water. And this guy goes out there, and in his moment of arrogance and self-righteous indignation, hits the rock with his stick and effectively says, do I have to do everything for you people? And that was the one thing that kept him out of the quote-unquote promised land in this book. You know, and I have to watch out for that. I have a tendency to develop that Moses complex. I have a tendency to come in here and decide that it's my job to take apart AA and what you're doing and straighten you out and show you how to do it right. You know, and the truth is that AA's been doing it wrong for, you know, quite a number of years, and they're doing it quite successfully. We're 2 million strong. You know, we've got a success rate that is phenomenal. We're the largest spiritual movement on the face of the earth. You know, I mean, this is a lot of stuff going on here. And the reason is because there's nobody, well, there's some people, but most of us aren't getting each other's face all the time telling each other how to do it right. What we do is we share our experience and not our knowledge. And so what I've learned to do is live sober. I've learned to be comfortable in the world and comfortable with my sobriety and comfortable with, well, most of your sobriety. I get a little self-righteous here and there. If you haven't had your evangelistic streak yet, wait for it. It's a good time. But I found that for me, I mean, the only medallion I carry on, I mean, we carry around these little brass medallions, a lot of us do, and the only one I've got is this little 24-hour medallion. Because for me, in this life, what I've got here and now is no longer having to stay sober forever. I never quit drinking. Think on that. I didn't quit drinking. I just didn't drink for today. I didn't drink for today, and I didn't drink for today one more day, and I didn't drink for today one more day. May 5th of 2001, I had my last drink, and I put down my last drink. And I've been coming here and being with you people since then. You know, what I have is right here and now. And I've come up with this description that I like, and I'll share it with you. Because it's hard to describe, but the way I see it, a lot of people, I mean, everybody that's going to the movies, right? Everybody likes going to the movies. I like going to the movies. When you go to the movie theater, you sit in there and this magic happens and transports you to another world, another reality, and life is beautiful and everything is great and it's wonderful. There's good, there's bad, there's happy, there's laughter and tears, everything's beautiful. And I'll tell you how that works and why that works. What happens is that they've got this movie projector in the back. And on the front of it, it's got this big supply reel supplying all of this film that's going through all these little wheels and cogs, and it's going behind this lens, past this light bulb, and then through a bunch more wheels and cogs and then up onto this take-up reel. And as it's being supplied, there's one little piece in there, this light bulb that's constantly flashing on only one picture at a time. Nothing but that, just that. It doesn't care what's happening next. It doesn't care how it gets there. It doesn't care what happens after it gets there. And it doesn't care about what happened in the past. Right here and now, it's flashing on that moment over and over and over again. And you know what? That's where the magic is. That's where the movie is. That's where the beauty is. That's where life is, you know? And if you want your life to be like the movies, the best possible thing you can do is learn to get right here and now. At the very end of Bill's story, there's a line in there where he says exactly that. We feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. And when I can get right here and now in the middle of life, you know, with you, in this world, and a part of this, and engage in the principles in this book. I mean, working the steps, it's not something you stand up and talk about, you know. I worked all 12 steps. I got involved in the steps. Thankfully, I didn't have a sponsor that told me some nonsense like, well, once you've found God, I'll take you through the steps. Thank God nobody like Bill W. said maybe to Dr. Bob, I'll take you through the steps when I think you're ready. We wouldn't have an Alcoholics Anonymous today. He said, here's what I did. If you want what I've got, let's do it. And he took him into it, and he took him into this process now, you know. And thankfully, he didn't tell him, well, you wait until you're ready. Well, you take the time you want, you know. Work that inventory when you feel like it. And, you know, he said, let's get involved in this process. And he took him through the process, and as a result, Dr. Bob recovered from alcoholism. And when I say recovered from alcoholism, I'm not going to get into any kind of debate over that. What I have is recovered from the obsession to drink. The obsession to drink is gone. It's been gone for a long time. And that goes away as a result of working the 12 steps. The 12 steps bring on a spiritual experience. It changes the way that I see the world. And it makes it so that I don't have to drink. I don't even want to drink. You know, when I came here, I didn't even know what it was like to not want to drink. I heard people talk about it. I thought they were bizarre, you know. It didn't make any sense to me to not want to drink. Everybody wants to drink, you know. And my way was the only normal one, and I couldn't differentiate the truth from the false, you know. And what I've gotten here is relieved of the obsession to drink. It's gone, you know. And as a result of working the spiritual principles and the 12 steps, little by little, other parts of my life come together, you know. Not because AA makes me wonderful, but because if I want to stay sober, I have to stay honest. And if I'm going to stay honest, I have to find out where I'm being dishonest. I have to figure out where I'm being inconsiderate and where I'm full of resentment and fear, you know. I have to determine whether or not my sex conduct is appropriate for me to not feel guilt, shame, and remorse every day, you know. And so as I go through the inventory and I take a look at this stuff, I discovered there was a lot of stuff about me that I didn't like. And once we discussed that with another person, I had to decide to myself, am I willing to let go of these things that I find objectionable? And the truth was, at that time, nope. I was having a really good time. My first sponsor, the late, great Kane Thompson, told me once that when I got my one-year cake, he said that he could count the number of suggestions I didn't take on one hand, and that was Amanda and Heather and Renee and Bobby Joe and... not that there's anything wrong with that. We're not the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct, you know. I mean, it's a matter of whether you're willing to grow and change spiritually. I was not. I was having a very good time. And at the time, I did my fifth step, and I was bulking at my sixth step. I was having a fling with this girl, looked a lot like a porn star, you know, Ron Jeremy. And, yeah, that was money. And it was one day I kind of woke up, and I thought, you know, what the hell? I'm trying to grow, I'm trying to change, I'm trying to get better, and what the hell is this? And I had what I consider to be a moment of grace, you know, a moment of grace. And I think everybody has a period of grace. You know, if you're new and you come in here and before you've worked the steps, you start to get a zeal and an enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous and you're charged and you're involved in the meetings and you're running around doing everything you can and you want to get into this process, don't let anybody feed you any crap about it being a pink cloud, okay? I think that that's a moment of grace. That's a period of grace that God gives to alcoholics who are willing to go to any lengths to get this. I think that's that period of time where God gives you the opportunity to be sober and happy about being sober just long enough to get your ass into the steps so that you don't have to drink before you get there. Use it. Get involved in it. Stay involved in that. Get involved in the steps. You know, don't walk out of here. Don't run out of here. And don't let anybody bully you out of here. There's a bunch of jackasses in AA. That's the problem with AA is it's full of alcoholics. Bunch of hard-willed, obnoxious, pushy people, and every single one of them is absolutely certain they're right. You know, so love and tolerance of others is our code, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, if you can develop a little bit of a sense of humor about this and have a little bit of fun about your recovery, you know, have fun with this because it is. I mean, look, we should all be dead. We should not be here. Alcoholics of my type don't live long enough to clean up, put on a suit, cut my hair. You know, and walk around like I care about anything. You know, and there's a whole bunch of us running around here, cleaned up, looking halfway as good, most of us anyway. And, sorry, Sam. And, I'm just playing. So, you know, and that right there, there was 150, 200 alcoholics, potentially dead people laughing all at the same time. That's God in the room to me, you know. That's where the magic is to me. That moment. And I'm going to hang on to that. I'm going to hang on to that for the rest of the day. I'll probably think about it a couple times over the next few days. Because when I came here, I wasn't laughing. You know, I was not having a good time. I was not enjoying myself. I wanted to die, and I was too scared to kill myself. What do you do with that? So, get involved in the step work. I finally, at that point, with that girl, decided I was sick and tired of this and called up my sponsor and said, what do I do? And he told me the page to turn to. He told me the two paragraphs to read, and he told me the prayer to read. And I did it, and nothing happened. I was a little disappointed, and I called him up and said, nothing happened. What do I do? He said, your eighth step. He said, go to your fourth step, which I still had. I didn't burn it. Some people do, some people don't. Not my job to tell you how to do this. I can only tell you how I did it, because it's not my place to tell you what you should do. It's only my place to tell you my experience. So what I did, I still have that fourth step. And I still go back over that from time to time, look and see if there's any new amends on there that I've missed or anything that I can do. And I took that and I made a list of people that I needed to talk to. And there was a lot of them, because I'm a jackass. And I lie, I gossip, I steal, I burglarized my dad's house for thousands of dollars of guns and sold them on the streets of Spokane for $100 and bought acid, you know. That's a hard load, you know. And there was a lot of other stuff on there. There was one page in particular of things that I didn't want to write them down. I'm not going to write these things down. I can't write these things down. You know, I've been trying for years, some of these since I was 5 years old, 7 years old, trying to get away from some of these things. And as I was doing this inventory, a little voice popped in my head and said, what do you think you're running from, Paul? God. So I wrote the stuff down in Elven because I'd been years ago studying Tolkien's handwriting in the back of the Lord of the Rings books. And I didn't want anybody to find out exactly what these things said, so if it works, you know. And I went and I started talking to these people that I'd hurt and these people that I'd harmed, and I started going to them and talking to them about, you know, not I'm sorry. In fact, I was told by one of my spiritual teachers, this lady that came to this meeting, I don't know if she's here anymore, but Mari one time said to me, you know, people don't want to hear I'm sorry. We've been saying I'm sorry for years. People want to hear I was wrong, what can I do to make it right? And if you already know what you did wrong, you shouldn't even have to ask what you need to do to make it right. You know? I already know what I did. If I stole money, I owe you money. If I lied about you, I need to go around and try and improve your reputation. I need to say kind things about people. I need to try and undo the damage, the wreckage, and the chaos that I've left in my wake for so many years. And so little by little, I'm going around to coworkers and taking them aside. I'm an alcoholic. I'm in a 12-step program of recovery, and I need to try and make amends. And They had what Bill Wilson talked about his banker having, that look of amused skepticism. Yeah. But I quit talking about people behind their back and letting people know about it. I still do sometimes, but I'm getting better at it. You know, I think if I'm honest, every single character defect I had when I came in here is still here. The difference is that much like alcohol, I've been given a choice. I don't have to lie today. I don't have to cheat today. I don't have to gossip today. I can. And for the record, gossip is any time you talk about somebody that's not in the room. think on that. You know, that for me is, that's a character defect I still have. And there's a lot of this stuff that little by little I'm improving my actions, but it's not my job to work on my character defects. Or step 7 would say we worked on our defects instead of we asked God to remove them. And what God's done is he's removed that absolute need to do those things. And he's given me back a moment of grace, a moment of choice, that couple of seconds before I act out that character defect, you know. So I made these amends. And today what I do is I try my very darn best to live by those principles. Step 10 is basically 4 through 9, over and over and over again, all day long, over and over. You know, I continue to look for, what am I doing wrong? Am I lying? Am I full of resentment, fear, frustration, selfish, dishonest? What's going on? You know, anytime I'm disturbed, it's because there's something wrong with me, and I need to get undisturbed before I can approach the problem. And I need to continue to make amends. I had an issue with a certain company here in town recently who, in my opinion, still wronged me considerably. And that doesn't give me the right to hang up on them. That doesn't give me the right to snap at them on the phone. That doesn't give me the right to be rude. And so what I had to do is, even though they were 99% of the problem and mostly wrong, is I called them up and said, what do I need to do to make this right? And they said, apologize. And rather than say, for what? I said, okay. To whom? And she gave me a phone number of a guy that I needed to call, and she said, if you could give me a written apology I can give to the people that I don't have their phone numbers when I see them, that would be nice. And so I did. And I wrote it up, and I emailed it to her. I called the guy, and he never did call me back. I called him several times, and he never called me back. I've done my part. My side of the street is clean. That's what I can do, you know. And that's all I can do is try and keep my side of the street clean. I continue to talk to the God of my understanding, a lack of understanding. The longer I do this, the less I seem to know. When I came here, I was full of religion. I was full of a lot of religion. I had all of the answers, and I could pull out a Bible and prove any one of you bastards wrong. Any one of you. And I was very combative about it, and I've come to find that for me, in my personal case, religion is not a good deal. It's not a good idea for me. I talk to a God 10, 20 times a day. I have a relationship with my God that I take with me on the way to work. I don't say, okay, God, I'm going to work. I'll see you when I get home. And I take God with me to work, and I do, you know, on my lunch breaks, he's with me. And on the way home, he's with me. And when I go to meetings, on the way home from meetings, when I go to pick up my kids, I try and bring my God with me when I do that stuff. I try to work with other alcoholics, you know. And I try to sponsor guys, and I've had a lot of fun sponsoring guys. Because I think Bill C. out in California said something about this, that every time I think of some person that I really don't want to work with, they walk across the room and ask me for help. And every single character defect that I have ever noticed in myself has wound up asking me to sponsor them, and it has been my pleasure to do so. I love doing that. I love working with other alcoholics because that's where the fun is for me. That's where the fun of this whole thing is for me, is when I sit down and talk to another drunk, whether it's over a coffee table or whether it's from one couch to another couch or whether we're driving in a vehicle, when I'm talking to another drunk and I'm seeing the lights come on in their eyes and they're starting to get it and I see them starting to nod when I'm talking about something, yeah, we got you. We got you. When you're laughing at the jokes we tell in here, we got you. You bet. And you never have to drink again. You don't have to drink again. You don't have to feel so damn miserable sober. You know, if you want to drink, have at it. We're not here to convince anyone they want to drink. Go for it. If you don't want to drink anymore and you find that you can't stop, welcome home. Because this is where we have a solution to that type of problem. That's what we do here. I think that another thing that is grievously often missed in AA is when people run around talking about how militantly busy they are 12-stepping and they're completely missing the second half. I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. So when I hold the door for somebody at the grocery store and let them through, I'm also practicing the 12-step. When I don't run that jerk off or cut me off in traffic and I don't run him off the road, I'm practicing the 12-step, you know. When my first sponsor, Kane, one time said that I was real new in sobriety. And I was on my way to the meeting, and I got to the meeting, I was just nuts, you know. And he was a little frustrated. And he was talking about how on the way to the meeting, some guy had cut him off in traffic. And he was just that close to flipping the guy the middle finger, giving him the old one-finger salute and ha-ha, you jerk. And he caught himself, again, that moment of grace, caught himself and thought, you know, if I flip him the bird, in 10 minutes I'm going to probably feel pretty darn guilty about that. I'm going to have to track that guy down and make amends for being such a jerk to him because I was wrong. And why in the hell would I want to track someone down and make amends to them when they were the one that did the thing wrong? Screw that, and he didn't flip him off. And it was like a spiritual awakening. I just thought, you can do that? You can just not flip somebody off? I had no idea, you know? And I don't think I've flipped a whole lot of people off since that, except maybe Steve W. and Howard and, you know, A couple of my friends, but that's nothing but love. You know? So, I mean, this is a lot of fun. I have a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. You people are my family. A lot of you people are closer to me than a lot of my family members are. Don't get me wrong. I love them. You know, my brother sobered up about 4 years ago, and he and I have gotten a hell of a good relationship. You know, and we don't get to see each other much, but we get online on the internet, and we get to playing Halo together and shooting bad guys and having a blast. And we cut it up, and we have a good time, you know? And we don't make it serious. Well, sometimes. But mostly, it's just about having a good time and being silly and playing. You know, and when we're not winning, we take turns and start shooting barrels instead. And the other team just sits and looks at us like, what the hell? We're not trash-talking anybody. We're not insulting people or swearing. We're just playing, you know. I have a relationship with my kids today. I have a relationship with my kids today. And sometimes that's a little bit difficult because they're kids. And I need you guys to stick around here because there's about a 50-50 chance either one of them is going to wind up here. And what I've told my ex-wife in the past is if they've got what's wrong with me, I can't help them. Can't. I'm too close to the problem. And if it got something other than what's wrong with me, I can't help them. I'm not qualified. What I get to do is I get to try and be a dad. I get to try and love them through whatever jack fool thing they do and try and be a father and try and be there for them. You know, I get to learn to love unconditionally. And if you're sitting here and you're resenting anybody, if you're hating anybody, if there's someone in your mind that you're sitting there thinking this is the one person I cannot forget or the one place or the one institution or the one whatever that I cannot forgive, get to thinking about who you were when you came in here. Get to thinking about your fourth step and the things that you wanted to write in Elvin, you know? And if I can come in here and through the grace of God be forgiven for the crap that I did and the way that I lived and the people that I hurt, who am I to say that nobody else should be forgiven, right? So, I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be an alcoholic because it means there's something that can be done about what's wrong with me. And I want to thank all of you for sitting through this crap. Have a good night.